Okay, we had begun discussing the instruction that David HaMelech gave to Shlomo regarding Shimi ben Gera. We pointed out the extraordinary fact that Shimi ben Gera was Shlomo's main Rebbe. Obviously a great Talmid Chacham, must have been a great person, and Shlomo had a very close relationship with him. Nonetheless, his view of the world was distorted, and the Pasuk suggests that the Negiah came from the fact that he was Ben Hayimini, that he was a relative of Shaul HaMelech, and therefore never really was able to accept David's Malchus. This despite, obviously, Shimi ben Gera was familiar, as anybody who learns Chumash is, that the Yaakov Avinu predicted that the Malucha would go to Shevet Yehuda. So it was destined that at some point in time the Malucha would come from Shevet Yehuda. Obviously David was from Shevet Yehuda, and knowing this and knowing it full well, and knowing that Shmuel Hanavi selected David, yet he still was convinced that David had no right to the throne. So we see again an example, and this comes up numerous times in Chazal and Tanakh, and in real life actually, how a person's biases and negiyas could distort his judgment so much. It's something that would seem obvious, particularly to such a great person, and yet it's not obvious at all, and somehow we're convinced that the exact opposite is true. I'm reminded a little bit of the Ramban in Parsha Shoftim in Sefer Devarim, where we have the mitzvah that everyone is mechuyev to listen to Sanhedrin, and it says Lo Sasser, there's the Parsha of Zakein Marmer, it says Lo Sasser Lo Sasser Min Adavar Shegidu Lecha Min Makom Ahu Yamin Usmal. So Chazal say, even if they tell you Al Yamin Shu Small, Al Small Shu Yamin, but if the Sanhedrin says that your right hand is your left hand and your left hand is your right hand, you still have to listen to them. So the Ramban explains, the reason for this is that since this only took place in the days when there was a Sanhedrin and a central Torah authority, Kajvoku didn't want the Torah to be divided into two and to have machlokasin. And therefore it was more important to maintain the central authority of Torah than to be right. And if it is, even though Sanhedrin may have been wrong, I am a better judge than Sanhedrin, I know that they're wrong, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants me to listen to them anyway for the sake of maintaining unity in Kal Yisrael. And certainly through the generations, after there was no longer a Sanhedrin, we see many divisions occurred within Kal Yisrael because, you know, there was no such ability to reach a final psak. So this is what the Ramban says, and then he adds, the Kol Shekein, and certainly you should understand that since Sanhedrin is entrusted with the job and the role of leading Kal Yisrael, that they will get a special siyata d'shmaya, and therefore it's more likely that they're the ones who are right and you're the ones who are wrong. So the Rosh Yeshiva pointed out that there seems to be a connection, a sequence, that first I tell you that you have to listen to them no matter what, and certainly you should understand that they're probably right and you're wrong. Why not start out saying, listen, they're probably right, and besides that, you have to listen anyway. And he explained that as long as you think you have the option not to listen to Sanhedrin, there must have been, if you are wrong, there is probably some bias, some negiah that led you to think that way. And as long as you have hope that you can fulfill your psak, that negiah will not let go of you. But once you've accepted the first part of the argument, that even though I'm right, I have to listen to Sanhedrin, it kind of weakens the negiah, because what's the point? There's no profit, there's no benefit. I'm going to have to listen to them anyway. So for example, suppose you made something mutter that Sanhedrin said is us, and the reason you made it mutter was because inside, in your heart, you really wanted to do this thing. But now you've accepted, I'm not going to do it anyway. So now you don't have a negiah anymore, at least not as much. Then you'll be able to realize maybe they were right. Even though until now, you were so convinced they were wrong that it's equivalent of telling you your right hand is your left hand is your right hand. We're not talking about judgment. I hear your point of view, but I think my side is better. I think you're absolutely off the wall. There is no shaychus to reality. You're telling me right hand is left. It's impossible. It's crazy. But you have to do it anyway. You know what? Maybe you're right. That is the power that a negiah, that a bias exerts over a person's reasoning. So, Shimi ben Gera was not exempt from this, as great as he was. And the pasuk continues, Mi Bachurim, simple pshat is that this is a place. Right? This was the identifying the place where he came from. But that does have a certain problem. Because why is it suddenly relevant to identify the place? We're in Pasuk Ches. It's not as if Shlomo doesn't know who he's talking about when he said, "Your Rebbe Shimi ben Gera." Now, which Shimi ben Gera did you have in mind? So he knows. So that leads a number of the Mefarshim to interpret that Bachurim is not a place, and even the Targum really implies that. And it means, it refers to the, as we say today, a Bachur. The Ulamas, from the young people, he was not a young person. Shimi ben Gera was an old man. But the idea was, what do we mean when we say a Bachur? We don't mean anything anymore, but where does the term come from? A Bachur means chosen, somebody who's elite. And the idea is somebody who devotes himself to learning Torah is chosen, he's the elite. So that's where the idea of a yeshiva bachur comes from. But the idea that Shimi ben Gera was from the elite, why is that relevant? Two explanations are given. Both, they complement each other, they're not in contradiction. First of all, the crime of Shimon Geres is going to be described as that he cursed David HaMelech. A curse from a Chashuva Talmud Chacham is much more dangerous and much more deadly than a curse from a simple person. And therefore, even though we say any kind of curse could have an impact, but it heightens the crime. If you're Mibachurim, if you're from the elite, if you're one of the great people, you got to be very careful what you say, because your words have more of an impact. And therefore, the crime of Shimi ben Gera to abuse that was greater. Secondly, from the concept or from the perspective of a Marad B'Malchus, the greater the person, the more dangerous he is. Because he will have a following, people who will respect him. If he was a simple private citizen that nobody knew about, nobody cared about, so one could perhaps ignore him with a certain amount of impunity, and it's not going to affect the Malchus. But if you're talking about an elite, great person who people respect, so if he's going to agitate against you, he's dangerous. So Tzai Mitzad, the curse being more effective, and also because he's a more dangerous enemy, therefore David highlights this expression to indicate that action needs to be taken. So what was the crime of Shimi ben Gera? Hu kilalani kalala nimretes. He cursed me with a curse nimretes, we'll define in a moment. The yom lefti machanayim, the day I went to Machanayim, this was the day that David HaMelech was running away from Avshalom, and he had been driven away from the throne. And at that point, Shimi ben Gera cursed him. And again, Shimi ben Gera felt that David didn't deserve the throne, and this was, in his mind, a vindication of his point of view. All these years, Shimi ben Gera kept silent, but now that he sees, oh, I'm right, he is being driven away from the throne. So I see that it was wrong, so then he expressed himself. What does nimretes mean? It's a difficult word to translate. And of course, this is probably why Chazal darshan it, why such a strange word was chosen to describe the curse. But the simple meaning, I found three interpretations. Rashi says, mefarash, it was an explicit curse. Sometimes you could curse by implication, but Shimon ben Gera said it outright. The Targum calls it Maririn, a bitter curse. And the Mitzudas, the Radaka, others call it Chazaka, a very strong curse. But the idea is, Nimretzis describes this curse as being quite significant, quite serious. It was explicit, it was bitter, it was strong and sharp. Before we get into a little more discussion of the nature of the curse, let's just finish the thought of the Pasuk. Who yarad likrasi hayarden, and he came to meet me at the yarden. Vasheva lo b'Hashem, I swore to him in the name of Hashem, lemor imamishcha b'chav, I will not kill him by sword. I will not kill him violently. What exactly happened? Shimi ben Gera did not earn his reputation as a great Talmud Chacham and did not get his position as being the Rebbe of Shlomo Melech because he was stupid. He was quite a smart person. And he cursed David HaMelech on his way out of the throne, thinking that his position had been vindicated. Now he sees David HaMelech is regaining the throne. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that he's in trouble. So what did he do? He made sure that he was the first one to greet David HaMelech as he's crossing the Yarden to come back to Yerushalayim and ask for forgiveness. Now, consider what's going on here. The reason why Avshalom was prevailing at the beginning was not simply because he had two or three advisors and a couple of strong men. It's because there were quite a few people that he won over to his side. And those who did not go over to his side were kind of standing on the fence, sitting on the fence. If Kal Yisrael would have rallied to support David HaMelech, Avshalom would have gotten no place. So really, there were probably thousands and thousands and thousands of people who shared some level of guilt in the rebellion of Avshalom. Here comes a big Talmud Chacham, well-respected individual, who also shared guilt in the rebellion, although he didn't actively rebel. Again, he wasn't part of Avshalom's army. He didn't do anything actually in the fight, but he did curse David HaMelech. What? Certainly it's something. Yeah, okay. But he isn't part of the army fighting against David. And he comes and he asks for forgiveness. If David says no, what happens to everybody else? He's the first one, so other people are going to be afraid. He comes and asks for forgiveness. David says no, chop off his head. So it would put David in a very difficult position. To say no to Shimi makes it that much more difficult to regain the loyalty of everybody else. Because everyone's afraid that they're in the same boat.
But they always been cursed.
They didn't curse him, but all right. But you know, they also support Hashem. Who knows how far David's going to go? People are afraid. So, Shimi ben Gera exploited this opportunity. Had Shimi ben Gera not been the first one, and others came and asked forgiveness, and David forgave them, and people see that he's accepting them, and then he doesn't accept Shimi, so they'll say, okay, Shimi was worse. I'm not as bad as Shimi. I will be accepted. But when Shimi's the first one, it sets a precedent that scares other people away. So this was the tactic that Shimi ben Gera exploited. So what is David saying? He says, he came to me first, forcing me to swear not to kill him. But that doesn't mean I forgave him. I swore that I would not take any action against him because he put me in a situation where I had no choice but to do that, otherwise it was going to be very difficult for the Melucha. But I never forgave him. The chait is still there. And he never really did tshuva. And therefore, although I am not able to kill him, I'm giving you instructions. We'll see exactly how that works in a moment, to kill him. The fact is, at the time that David HaMelech was running away and Shimi originally cursed him, David's supporters wanted to kill Shimi right then and there. At that point, David said no. That had nothing to do with being coerced or with this setup. The Mefarshim explained there was a different reason there because David himself was not so sure that he was still a king. David said, I've been dethroned, I've been chased away, and Taka, maybe I'm not a melech. Maybe Shimi ben Gera is right. Not because of Shaul, he knew it wasn't because Shaul was supposed to kill him, maybe because of my own chataim, I forfeited the throne. So it's my chait that's doing this to me. When David was reinstated as king, he understood that that really wasn't the case. He had to suffer and run away, and therefore I am a melech. So it was never that he excused Shimi. It was his own assessment of himself was such that perhaps my chait caused me to lose melucha. When he saw that wasn't the case, he would have really taken care of Shimi right then and there. But Shimi arranged it, was clever, to come first, and therefore put David on the spot. David never exonerated or forgave Shimi for the chait. What you mentioned about him going to heaven comes in the next pasuk. We'll get to that a little bit later.
Why have Shimi teach your son? There's got to be other coming up. Why use Shimi to teach your son?
Interesting question, but it could be that Shimi was his Rebbe from beforehand. And, you know, You know what they say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, like if it's working out, lav mikol adam zolchaluma. There's a halacha that says that if a person goes to galus because he killed somebody b'shogeg, his Rebbe has to go to galus with him. So the Gemara asks the question, why does the Rebbe have, because it says v'chai, he has to live there. Part of his life is to have a Rebbe. So it says, why does the Rebbe have to go? There are other people in the city who could teach him Torah. So the Gemara says, if you're successful with one Rebbe, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be successful with another Rebbe. So the person has the right to say, I know this Rebbe I can learn from. By the way, the Gemara's advice, therefore, is you should be careful who you take as Talmidim. You may end up having to go along. But so it could be that he had him as a Rebbe from beforehand, before he realized there was any issues with Shimi ben Gera, and at that point he didn't want to change. Now what we see, by the way, from here, which is a concept that we find in halacha, that when you put a person in a position where he quote-unquote agrees to do something but he really doesn't want to, that's not an agreement. You can't sort of rely on that. Sometimes you put a person on the spot and you ask them to do something and they don't really want to do it, but you did it in such a way they couldn't say no, so you think you got their rishus, you got their permission. In Shemayim, they don't look at it that way. A sort of extreme example of that is the halacha of Su'uda Shenim Aspekas Sabayla. That's a situation where a person is a poor person and doesn't really have enough food for himself, and you sort of accept an invitation or wangle an invitation for a meal and you deprive him of the thing he needs for himself. So he says yes. In some cases he may even initiate the invitation, but you're supposed to be smart enough to say no. And if you say yes, so you say, well, he agreed, I didn't steal, I mean, he said yes. When a person agrees but he doesn't really mean it, that's not, I mean, b'day adam, it's an excuse. You're not a guy, no bezin is ever going to force you to do anything. But b'day shemayim, it's not so simple. So this was a se'uda she'enim aspekas abayla. Shimi ben Gera got David to agree, but David never really agreed. Now what does nimretzes mean? We said the simple translation, different opinions. Chazal darshan that nimretzes is a rashi tevis. Nun Mem Reish Tzadisav stands for Noef, an adulterer. What does that refer to? That refers to the Chait of Bathsheba, which whether it was technically an adulterer or not, but it was certainly close enough that Shimi could include that in his accusation. Moavi, all right, that he was a descendant of Moav and there was some controversy whether or not he was kosher, because Allah is Moavi v'lo Moavis. That a woman from Moab is kosher to marry a Jew, but there are those who still apparently do not accept that. Rotzeach is a murderer. This refers to Uriah, the husband of Bathsheba, who he sent out in battle to die. Sorer, he is an enemy. This refers to the fact that he took over the Malucha from Shaul. When Shaul HaMelech died, so the supporters of Shaul attempted to install Ish-Boshes as the king, and David really fought against them. There was a battle to a certain extent, and David prevailed, although he did not pursue the enemy. That was actually Yoav's decision. You know, we are mentioning all the bad things about Yoav, but you know, he restrained so that not to maintain a civil war amongst Jews. But the fact is that through his enmity, so to speak, he drove eventually Ish-Boshes and the family of Shaul out of the Malucha. And the last one is Toeva. That's the difficult one. There is no clear reference to what Shimi ben Gera was saying when he said Toeva. The Gemara, some of Farshim suggest they connect this to a Gemara in Sanhedrin. A fascinating Gemara in any case, so it's worth mentioning. At the time that David HaMelech was driven away from the throne by Avshalom, the Gemara says that David HaMelech had a havamina, had a thought that he should serve Avodah Zarah in public. Why? Because he was afraid that there was going to be a great Chilul Hashem, because David HaMelech was a big tzaddik, and look at the terrible thing that's happening to him. His own son rebels against him, he's being driven from the throne, If anything, he expected he might very likely be killed by his own son. People will see that and say, if that's how HaKadosh Baruch Hu treats tzaddikim, what hope is there for the rest of us? So he thought that if he served Avodah Zarah in public, people would see that he's not a tzaddik, and they would understand why these things are happening to him. And they would therefore minimize the Chilul Hashem. And Mefarshim explained that technically it really wouldn't be Avodah Zarah, because Avodah Zarah is totally on your intent. If he's only doing it for the intent of Kiddush Shem Shemayim, it's technically not Avodah Zarah, but at least, in his heart, but Sof Kol Sof, he's violating the Avera of Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah is called Toeva. So the fact that he had such a thought to serve Avodah Zarah can be a Toeva. Hushai Ha'arki, who was David's friend, argued with him. Hushai Ha'arki said that you don't have to worry. People will understand anyway. He says, why? Because you married a Yifas Torah. Right? There's a parsha in the Torah that if you go into battle and you see an Isha Yifas Torah, a beautiful woman, amongst the captives, so go through a certain process and you're allowed to marry her. But this in the beginning of Parashas Kisaitse, the next parsha says if you have two wives, one is loved and one is hated. And then the next parasha has Ben Sora Mora, rebellious son. And there's a drasha that these are connected. If you marry an Eishes Yifas Torah, you will have a hated wife, and the son will be a rebellious son. So that's exactly what happened. You married, I don't know about the hated wife, I guess that was there too, but you married an Eishes Yifas Torah, and the child who was born, which is Avshalom, became a Ben Sora Mora. Nobody's going to have any questions, either Rabbah. It's fulfilling the drasha that's predicted in the pasuk. So there won't be a Chil Hashem. So David Melch accepted that and he didn't do it. So the fact that he had such a thought to serve Avodah Zarah makes him a Toeva. The difficulty with this, at least in Shimi's view, the difficulty with this chat is the chronology. Because it's not clear exactly when this happened, but I guess, the Gemara says it happened when he was running away from Hashalom. Well, Shimi's curse also happened when he's running away from Hashalom. So it makes the timetable somewhat tight. Maybe the incident with Hushai Ha'arki took place immediately prior to when Shimi got a hold of him. But that is the suggestion of some of the Mefarshim. Otherwise, it's just a little bit unclear where the reference to Toeva comes from. It's a fascinating Gemara, but you see whether David HaMelech's question was correct or not, you see the magnitude of Chil Hashem. As if because of Chil Hashem, David HaMelech was, so to speak, ready to give up everything and to go down in history as a Rasha and maybe lose, who knows what the din will be in Shemayim for what he does. And it's also a Chil Hashem for him to serve Avodah Zarah, but he thought it would be a bigger Chil Hashem the other way. It's a tremendous thing. And Chushai's argument was, don't worry, there won't be such a Chil Hashem. We don't know what the answer would have been if Chushai did not have this counter-argument. So the concept of Chil Hashem is enormous, and obviously we're not David HaMelech, but it's something that we need to keep in mind each in our own way. By the way, just a small aside, that part of the, and some of us do suggest it, that part of the reason why David again refers to the nature of the curse, Kol Nimretzes, was to indicate why Shlomo needs to take action. And again, we've discussed this concept in reference to Yoav, that even if Shimi ben Gera was a Morav B'Malchus, that doesn't get passed on to the next generation. So why should Shlomo take action against Shimi? Shimi didn't do anything to Shlomo. So the answer is he did. Because included in that curse was the curse of Moavi, which is to imply that David is not roy to be a king because his yichus is improper. Well, that would apply to Shlomo as well. Including the curses that he's a Noev, which means that he had no right to marry Bathsheba, who was Shlomo's mother, that also could disqualify Shlomo from being king. So the attack that Shimi ben Gera attacked David was really an attack on Shlomo as well, and therefore Shlomo also had the right as a melech to take action. Well, Chaim Shmulevitz adds a additional twist, or different twist, I'm not sure, to the concept, and suggests, being by the parsha of Yoav and also by the parsha of Shimi ben Gera, that there is another element that played a role, and that is that the responsibility of the king, amongst other things, is to promote justice, din. And din requires that punishment be administered. And if prominent people do serious crimes and get away with it, it breaks down the concept of justice. And there's an interesting, hashkafa in terms of justice that isn't readily realized in our Western societies. The concept of Ein Rachamim B'din. There's a place for Rachamim, for mercy, but there's a place for justice as well. And to a certain extent, society has it distorted. There is a halacha that says, Lo sisa p'nei dov, lo sedar p'nei gadol, that when a person is a judge, you shouldn't show favoritism to a poor person, nor should you give honor to a rich person. Now, we already have a mitzvah that you're not allowed to distort judgment. Lo sasu avo b'mishpat. So then why is it necessary to say you shouldn't favor a poor person? That's a distortion of justice. Why is it necessary to say you shouldn't honor a rich person? And Rashi brings down, Chazal say, that a judge could have a cheshbon. A judge will say, listen, the poor person deserves tzedakah. This rich person should be helping the poor person. Because he's wealthy, he should give tzedakah. The poor person needs help. Now it's true, apidin, the rich guy is right. You know, there's a din Torah. He was sued for $1,000. He doesn't owe him $1,000, but he should give him the tzedakah anyway. But tzedakah is very embarrassing. The guys will go begging. Maybe he'll say yes. Maybe so. No, I'll tell you what. I'll rule in favor of the poor person so that the ultimate toelah shall be accomplished. What should happen will happen. And this, if I don't, who knows whether this rich person is going to do his job? That's what a person might think. Conversely, a person might say the other way around. Listen, he's an honorable, respectable person. If he loses a din Torah, you know, it's going to hurt his reputation. The poor person, you know, nothing's going to happen to him. So why don't I just rule in favor of the rich person? And then on the side, privately, I'll tell the rich person, go help him out. Taka, you won the case. But the guy needs help. Give him tzedakah. So says the pasuk, no, don't do that. Ein merachamim b'din. Social purposes can't be accomplished through the means of the justice system. The justice system has to administer justice, or else society will break down. Tzedakah has to be done as well. Chesed has to be done as well, but not within the judicial system. At the same time, every person needs to be treated with respect, including the criminals. You have to serve justice, but you can't be vindictive. We have a halacha that even when you're executing a person as chayiv misa, you have to do it in the most dignified and least painful way because of the mitzvah of ahavta l'reicha kamocha. You still have to treat the person with respect. What happens often in society is the exact reverse. When it comes to administering justice, we make excuses. Oh, they had a guy had a difficult life, you know, this, that, the other thing, and we tend to, sometimes, it's changing a little bit, but tend to be somewhat lenient. Once he's convicted, you dump him in a prison, you warehouse them and treat him like an animal, and with no respect. It's a reverse system. I remember years ago, we called it the Attica Shmooze. So I don't know how many of us are old enough to admit remembering Attica. But Attica is a maximum security prison in upstate New York. And quite a few years ago, there was a prison riot. And it lasted for a number of days. It was a big deal. The prison riot, whatever it was, I don't know exactly what they were complaining about. But the Attica prison uprising. And the Rosh Yeshiva said a shmooze at that time, applied it to the situation. There is a Braisa in Masechet Derech Eretz that says that when Adam HaRishon sinned in Gan Eden, Kadosh Baruch Hu said, Ayeka. So where are you? Says the Braisa, from here we learn that you don't enter a house without knocking, even your house. If there are people inside, you don't enter without knocking. It's not Derech Eretz to barge in on somebody. So the Shiva pointed out, barging in on who? Adam HaRishon just committed a crime which was gozer misa to the entire world, himself and everybody who came after him. That means he was a capital offense. Whose house was HaKadosh Baruch Hu's house? What did he do? He wrecked the place, so to speak. Right? Because the whole world was niskalkel as a result of Adam's chet. So imagine, a person has a big, fancy mansion. He invites a guest into his house. And he tells him, but just, make sure you take care of the premises. So the guy throws a wild party and wrecks the place. And he hears about it. And he's catching him in the act. He's in the middle of doing it. Just finished doing it. Knock on the door before you enter. Derech Eretz. He's a convicted criminal. Derech Eretz. Should be treated with Derech Eretz. The yeshiva said the yesod of the problem was that when it comes to the administration of justice, they show rachmanis. Ein merachmin bedin. You can't do that. When it comes to the post-judicial part, there's no Derech Eretz. So of course you're going to have situations where you're dealing not exactly with the upper class of society to begin with, but if they're treated with contempt, it's going to exacerbate the problem. So the correct attitude is you have to enforce justice. And sometimes that means you can't forgive people. But on the other hand, you never lose sight of the fact that as bad as a person may be, he's still a person, and there needs to be a sense of dignity. Alright, the pasuk continues, pasuk tes. V'yatra al tinakeyu, and now you shall not cleanse him, not let him go free. Ki ish chachamata, because you are a wise man. V'yadata eis asher ta'asa lo, and you will know what to do with him. V'arata sevaso b'dam shal, and you should bring down his old age in blood to the grave. We'll start with the end of the pasuk. Get a little simpler before I get into some of the more complex issues. The Mitzudas points out again, as he did by Yoav, that David uses the expression sevaso, his old age, that you shouldn't have rachmanis on Shimi ben Gera because he's an old man. You have to respect an old person. So he's reinforcing this feeling. Don't worry about it. You have to do it anyway. Don't get swayed by this feeling of respect for old age. What makes it a little bit more fascinating here, and this relates to the question that was raised, was that there's another, perhaps more obvious reason why one would think that Shlomo would be reluctant to carry out this instruction. That's because Shimon ben Gera was his Rebbe. And that David doesn't really say. He did allude to the fact that he was his Rebbe, but he wasn't mechazek him. He didn't say anything to say, don't worry, he's your Rebbe, kill him anyway. But he does say that about old age. So why was David HaMelech afraid that Shlomo might be deterred by the age of Shimon ben Gera and not by the fact that Shimon was his Rebbe, he's a Talmud Chacham? And I would suggest that perhaps the reason is because one would assume, and it's actually very clear from Chazal, we'll get to him, Yisrael Shem, next parak, I don't know how long it'll take to get there, that Shlomo was greatly influenced by Shimon ben Gera and had a great deal of cover for him. But it's easier to understand that if Shimon ben Gera was a chote, that he sort of forfeits the privilege that he has as a Rebbe. The whole reason why I give respect to my Rebbe is because he brings me Torah, because of what he represents. If he violates what he's supposed to represent, so then I'm not mechuyev the kavod for a Rebbe. But the kavod for an old person is not based on his merits. Right, the pasuk uses two terminologies, seva and zakein. Zakein refers to zeh shekana chachma, talmud chacham. And Chazal say zakein afa pisha eino seva. You have to respect the talmud chacham even though he's not old. Seva, an old person, afa pisha eino zakein, even though he's not a talmud chacham. Because the mere fact that the person is old and has experienced life gives him a certain status, and there's a certain attitude that you're supposed to have. So it could be that Shlomo would reason, okay, the fact he's my Rebbe, I understand, he's my Rebbe, but he violated Torah, he violated his trust, so he has to be killed, but he's an old man. What about that? So he needed chizuk, or at least David was afraid that he maybe needed chizuk in the department of Mipnei Seva Takum, but he did not necessarily need chizuk in the department of covet for his Rebbe. What is this instruction? Do not al tinakeyu ki ish chachamata. Right, you're a wise man, you'll know what to do, don't let him off the hook. What exactly is David telling him to do? Isn't he telling him to kill him? What's the great wisdom in that? Just you'll kill him. So clearly the implication is that you can't just kill him. You've got to find an excuse. You've got to find a reason. Why is that? Because self cuts off, and this again is the majority opinion, a little bit later we'll get to a differing opinion, but the opinion of Rashi, Rabag, and others is that really Shimi ben Gera deserved to be put to death. And Shlomo, David was completely within his rights to give such an instruction to Shlomo. But how would it look? David promised not to kill him, and here David tells Shlomo to kill him. So it looks like David is killing him, like he violated his promise. So unless you find new grounds to take action, it would be a problem. You might call it Maris Ayin, but it's a problem that it would involve certainly at least the appearance of David HaMelech violating his shvuah. So what David is saying to Shlomo is you have to find a new reason, a new excuse. What this basically is, I guess the terminology we would use today is you're setting him up. You've got to find a way to set him up so that you could find an opportunity to kill him. This is permissible because really he should be killed. It's just that there's a problem of appearances, of Maris Ayin. So you find a way to avoid that problem, but the motive is to kill him. Of course, the setup that will follow is that he is going to give instructions to Shimon ben Gera not to leave Yerushalayim. We'll get to more details about that later. And eventually, Shimon did leave Yerushalayim, and that was what caused his ultimate downfall. But you have to find a way that you could nail him on something else, even though the implication is that it was all made up. If not for the fact that I was out to get Shimi, I would have never given him such instructions. I would have never done such a thing. But I know that he deserves it. Okay, we'll stop here for now.